Coming up in a few minutes' time, the last time he was on, we got so much response. He's just brilliant. His last book was Sapiens, A History of Humankind. Barack Obama is a big fan of his. He's written a new book. It's called Homo Deus. It's about the where we're going in the future.
I'd like to know.
Well, yeah. He's got some very interesting theories on it. In a few minutes, for this week's Mind Expanding Monday, stay tuned. We are joined by Yuval Noah Harari. And for this week's Mind Expanding Monday, talking about his new book, Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow, I'm delighted to welcome back Yuval Noah Harari. Hello.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here again.
Well, it's an amazing thing because, I mean, so much has happened in your life since you were last here, because you were last here talking about your book, Sapiens.
Yes.
And then I believe Barack Obama heard you on this programme and he called you his book of the year, and then it's all changed for you since then.
Yes, there's been so much publicity. I mean, from an anonymous historian, I turned out to be some kind of celebrity historian.
Yeah, you're a rock star historian.
As far as historians go, yes.
So the last book, I mean, by its very nature, was history. It was looking at the sort of broad history of mankind. This one is looking at the future. Isn't prediction a mug's game?
Well, I'm not really trying to predict how the world would look like in 2050. Nobody has the slightest idea how the world would look like in 2050. It's more like trying to map the different possibilities so that we'll do our best to avoid the worst scenarios. I mean, if you listen to people in places like Silicon Valley or like in the big corporations like Amazon and Apple and so forth, so they constantly tell you that technology will create paradise on Earth. And I think it's the responsibility of people in the social sciences, of historians, of philosophers, to give a more critical view of where we are heading.
So the introduction to the book is, you say that humans have overcome the three main threats that have troubled us for centuries, in fact, for our whole existence. I like to talk about those in turn. The first one is war. Now, people will be listening to this and thinking, wasn't the 20th century the bloodiest century in history? Can you talk to me about the idea that we've vanquished war?
Well, the 20th century has certainly been very violent, but in the last few decades, and certainly today, we are in the most peaceful era ever in human history. It doesn't mean that there is no violence at all. I come from Israel, so I know perfectly well that there is still violence in certain parts of the world. But if throughout history about 10% of human mortality was caused by human violence, today it's about 1% globally.
How about countries? Because with the internet, borders are less important. You can connect with somebody in another country very easily. We also, in the affluent West, we can travel a lot more easier than any other point in history. And yet there is this rise in, you know, you could call it patriotism, you could call it isolationism. If borders and countries are becoming less important, if those structures are fading away, why do you think there's this rise of very nationalistic feelings?
Well, partly it's a reaction to a chaotic world of uncertainty. The world is changing more and more around us. Old certainties are giving way, and people are afraid of change. So they want to hold on to something that they think is eternal. So they turn to religion or to nationalism. But it won't really work. And even with nationalism, at least in a place like Europe, the Middle East is different, but in a place like Europe, with all the talk about the rise of nationalism and Brexit and the Scottish referendum and Catalonia and so forth, you just have to put it in perspective by thinking where we were a century ago. In 1916, Europeans were killing each other by the millions because of nationalism in the First World War. Today, when Britain leaves the EU, there is no chance that next year Britons and Germans will kill each other by the millions in trenches in Flanders or somewhere. And if you think about, let's say, Scotland breaking away from the UK, 2 centuries ago, or 3 centuries ago, when Scots wanted and tried to break away from the United Kingdom, the English sent armies north to burn down towns and basically to commit genocide in the Scottish Highlands. Now, if next year, let's say you have another referendum in Scotland and the Scots vote to leave the United Kingdom, I don't think we'll see an English army marching north to burn down Edinburgh and kill the Scottish Highlanders. Maybe you'll have one or two isolated incidents of a political murder, but in essence, Scotland can leave United Kingdom without any violence. So the strength of national feelings today are nothing like what they were a century or two centuries ago. People may toy with nationalism, and it may be still important to their identity, but at least in Europe, in Western Europe, they are no longer willing to kill and be killed for their nationalist views.
If nation states start to become less important, who is providing things like schools and hospitals and roads? Is it just the market? Does it go to corporations?
That's a big question, and the even bigger question is whether they'll continue to provide schools and hospitals and so forth. What we need to remind ourselves is that in the 20th century, the main reasons that governments across the world, even in authoritarian regimes, provided education and health and welfare for the masses wasn't the ethical argument, but it was practical considerations. Even dictatorial regimes like in Nazi Germany invested heavily in the health and education of the masses, because the Nazis knew, Hitler knew, that if he wanted Germany to be a strong nation with a strong army and a strong economy, he needed millions of poor Germans to serve as soldiers in the army and as workers in the factories. So, and of course, these soldiers needed to be healthy and relatively well educated. So even Nazi Germany had a vested interest in investing in education and health. Now, in 50 years, most humans might become militarily and economically useless. It's actually already happened in the military. Mm. Today in the military, you don't need most people. You need small numbers of elite professionals, like the special forces, and you increasingly need sophisticated technology, like drones and like cyber warfare. You don't need the millions. And if this also happens in the civilian economy, we may soon reach a point when it's unclear whether the state and the elites will still have the practical incentive to build schools and hospitals and so forth. In a place like the UK, the strength of the liberal tradition and of the welfare state may be enough to sustain mass education and mass health and welfare. But in newly developing countries like Nigeria or Brazil or India, if you take away the economic and military incentive, the ethical incentive by itself may not be enough. And then we may see the creation of the most unequal societies that ever existed in history.
I just want to pause there. The book is Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. My guest is Yuval Noah Harari, and we'll talk some more in a minute. It's Absolute Radio, Mind Expanding Monday. Our guest this week, Yuval Noah Harari. His new book is Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. You touched on this just before. You were saying that the liberalism we see in perhaps European countries isn't being replicated in countries which are developing now. And in the book, you talk a lot about the end of the age of humanism, mm-hmm. and you sum up humanism in five images. Yes. And I wondered if for people who aren't, don't know the concept, we could talk about each of those images and you explain what it means in terms of humanism. So the first one would be the voter knows best.
Yes, I mean, humanism in essence is the belief that the highest authority in the universe is human feelings and human free will and human choices. So in politics, humanist politics means a political system in which the highest authority is the feelings of individual humans. If you want to know whether Britain should leave the EU, you don't ask the Queen, you don't ask the Pope, you don't ask the Archbishop of Canterbury, because they are not the authority. You ask the individual humans who make up the British population, how do you feel about the UK leaving the EU? So this is humanist politics.
Right, and then the idea being that in the future you wouldn't go back to asking a queen or an authority, mm-hmm. but there would be so much data on you, the data will be able to make that decision for you based on your preferences and what you know and what you're...
Well, Google will be able to vote for you, or Facebook will be able to predict your voting and also to say what is really good for you. I mean, at present, the electoral system privileges not the individual, but the individual on a particular day in the year. I mean, you go once every 4 years to the election and you vote, and very often you forget what you thought a year or two before, and you're open to all kinds of manipulation in the weeks before
the
election.
Campaigning, yeah.
In campaigning and so forth. But Google or Facebook could follow you for the whole 4 years and could track your feelings, your emotions, your thoughts throughout these 4 years, and it will be much more difficult to manipulate your vote if you actually give Facebook the authority to vote for you, representing your views for the whole 4 years. I mean, even today, I don't want to sound it like a conspiracy theory, and I don't think it's actually being done, but I think even today with the presidential election in the US, Facebook can decide the election because it has the most important data about the political process. The US elections will be decided by a few swing states.
Sure.
And in those states, the election is decided by a relatively few number of people who are swing voters. Now, the most important information in the political system today is who are the 120,000 people in Michigan who still haven't made up their mind what they're going to vote. And the second most important piece of information is how to make these 120,000 people vote X and not Y. Now, who has this information? Facebook has it.
Yeah.
Provided these people have a Facebook account, then Facebook could know if they are swing voters, and it could also know what you need to say in order to swing your vote. Now, how does Facebook know all that? It's because we give it this information for free in exchange for funny cat videos.
Oh, what is wrong with us?
And there is, I just heard this really wonderful saying, which says that if you get something for free, you should know that you are probably the product.
That's great. That's
and,
really good.
And this is the Facebook and the Amazon and the Google model.
Yes.
They give you all these funny cat videos for free, and then they turn you into the product.
They're collecting the data. The next thing in this page of images was the customer is always right, which, I mean, that feels like almost like one of the central tenets of capitalism.
And also of humanism. Mm. It's the same to the voter knows best. I mean, in the political system, the highest authority is the individual voter. In the economic sphere, the highest authority, at least theoretically, is the customer. How do you know if a product is good or not? You just ask the customers. The customers vote with the credit cards. How do you know if a corporation is good or bad? It all depends on the customers. If they buy the products, it means that the corporation is good because it produces things that people want.
And in the same way as in an election campaign, we're susceptible to campaigning, we are susceptible to advertising, of course. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that companies like Google or Facebook, they could eventually kill the advertising industry?
They are already, changing it more than killing it. I mean, if you think, who is the audience of the advertisement industry? So today, or until today, the audience was us, human beings. But this is no longer the case. Even in 2016, the most important audience for advertisement in many places, certainly on the internet, is not a human being. It's an algorithm. It's the Google search engine. If you have a business and you want people to buy your product, then you have to advertise yourself above all else to the Google search engine.
Right.
How do you do it? You don't put a picture of a naked algorithm splayed over a red car. You design somehow your web page, your advertisement in such a way. I mean, I know it from the book industry.
Yes.
I mean, they ask me to write like a short synopsis of the book to place on the internet. And then I write something, and they have a special person who specializes in changing, in customizing what I've wrote so that the Google search engine would like it.
Wow.
I mean, you use particular words, you use particular terms that you know, or you guess, that the Google search engine likes.
Well, I'm just looking at the time here. I don't think we're going to be able to do all five images of humanism because I've got so much else to talk to you about. I just wanted to come on to this one. Think for yourself.
Think for yourself.
I mean, this is broadly speaking what we're talking about with these other two. We won't need to think for ourselves.
Somebody will do the thinking for us better than us. I mean, the big slogan of humanist education, because the voter knows best, because the customer is always right, so what you need to educate people is how to connect to their own feelings and how to think for themselves. This was the highest aim of humanist education. But more and more, the idea is, no, you don't need to think for yourself, because there is out there a system, an algorithm that knows you better than you know yourself, that constantly collects data about you, about your feelings, about your choices. And we are very close to the point where indeed an external algorithm could know you and your feelings better than you know them yourself. Why do you feel the way you do? Mostly, we don't know why we feel the way we do. But with the new breakthrough in biotechnology and in computer science, I mean, you could constantly monitor what's happening inside your body, what's happening inside your brain using biometric sensors. And then an algorithm that analyzes all this immense amount of data coming from inside your body, it will not only know what you're feeling, it will also know why you feel the way that you do.
I need to take a minute to take all this in. The book is Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. My guest for this week's Mind Expanding Monday, Yuval Noah Harari. It's Absolute Radio, Mind Expanding Monday. Yuval Noah Harari is back. The last time he was here, he was talking about the past, the entire history of mankind. This time he's looking at the future, A Brief History of Tomorrow, and how it could pan out. The book is called Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. So when we see sci-fi, it's all very dystopian. Mm-hmm. And when we it's the singularity is when human computer brains equal and then better human brain. That's mm-hmm. right. And when we see that the robots often turn on the humans, mm-hmm. Whereas you argue that it's perhaps going to be more similar the way the robots and computers will see us to how we see animals.
Yes. I mean, we can learn something about the way we treat animals. We learn from that to how all these powerful algorithms might see and treat us. But I don't want it to sound too dystopian. Mm. I think that science fiction is extremely interesting and provocative, but it often gets things wrong. The wrongest notion that most science fiction movies and novels have is that artificial intelligence will also mean artificial consciousness. They usually mix up intelligence and consciousness. Intelligence is the ability to solve problems. Consciousness is the ability to feel things, to have subjective experiences of love and pain and hatred and so forth. Usually in science fiction, when the computer develops intelligence, it also develops consciousness. Mm. And then it tries to take over the world and kill people. This is extremely unlikely because we've so far seen very rapid advance in computer intelligence, but exactly zero advance in computer consciousness. And this is because we become very good in understanding intelligence, but we know almost nothing about consciousness. We don't understand consciousness. Biologists think that consciousness somehow emerges from biochemical reactions in the brain, but they don't know. How is it that when billions of neurons are firing in a particular pattern, how does this create the subjective feeling of love or hate or pain? We have absolutely no idea.
So with the computers, in some ways, the way they're existing with that intelligence, would it be similar to how an animal exists? Like sometimes there's a beautiful sunset and I try and show my dog and she's not interested at all.
Yeah, but I mean, animals are conscious. They have minds, they have emotions, they have feelings. All mammals, all birds, and at least some reptiles and fish have emotions and feelings. And even though your dog may be less aware than you are to the wonderful sunset, she or he are much more aware than you to the wonderful smells
sure.
all around the environment. And you go to you walk your dog and it suddenly smells the something on the tree. And this is amazing. Come
yeah.
smell that. And you try to take it away. And the dog says, why doesn't he smell this wonderful thing that is happening here? So I think as far as As far as intelligent go, yes, we are more intelligent than dogs or than cats or pigs and so forth. But as far as emotions and sensations go, I think we give ourselves too much credit. And I don't think that on the emotional and sensory level, humans are so much superior to other animals.
Yeah, just because we can enjoy a piece of music or see a sunset, that's valuable to a human being, and that's as far as it goes, right? And yet we put all this value
When you think about music, I mean, whales may have much superior musical sensibility than human beings. I mean, we don't know that for sure, but we do have some indications that whales have audio abilities far superior to human beings, and you have all these whale songs. And of course, we as humans, we can't tell the difference between a whale Beethoven and a whale Justin Bieber.
Right.
But the whales are probably able to tell the difference.
Because in the book, you get into the idea that the idea of true self is an invention.
Yeah, it disintegrates. I mean, because you think that feelings are the most important thing in the world, then there is an irresistible desire to control the most important thing in the world. But once you gain control over it, it loses its power, loses its authority.
Before we finish, if humans are no longer have an economic value, what does life look like on a day-to-day basis? I mean, what are we doing?
We have absolutely no idea what life would look like in 40, 50 years. I mean, it's the first time in history when we have no idea how life would look like, even on the most basic level. How do you spend your day? What kind of job you have, if any? What does your body look like? What does gender relations look like in 50 years? We just don't know.
And at other points in history, you could kind of make a rough guess 50 or 100 years into
the future.
Yes,
I mean, if you look, say, 1,000 years ago in 1016 in England, there are many things you don't know about England of 1050. Maybe the Vikings will invade. Maybe there'll be a big plague. Maybe there'll be a change of dynasty. But about the basics, you knew. I mean, everybody will still be peasants, except for a tiny minority. So you get, even in 1050, you'll get up in the morning and you go to the field to harvest corn. You knew that men will still dominate women. You knew that most people will have a life expectancy of, say, 35 or 40. Today, you look to the UK of 2050, you have no idea what the job market looks like. Most jobs today will disappear by 2050. If there are new jobs, we don't know what they are. You don't know what gender relations would look like. Even if you still have a clear distinction between men and women in 2050, this is not absolutely clear. You don't know what life expectancy would be like. Maybe in 2050, 80 is the new 40.
Yeah.
So the whole structure of life, our family relations, everything is up for grabs.
And I don't suppose you could tell me just before we go how I would become one of the super upgraded humans at the top of the hierarchy in future.
If you have a lot of money, it will help.
Damn. Yuval, thank you so much for coming back. The book is Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. Yuval Noah Harari, thank you.
Thank you.